Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the podcast that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, aka The Passenger, and football finance expert Kieran Maguire, aka The Stig from Top Gear. Now, later we'll be hearing from Tom Greatorex, who's vice chair of the Football Supporters Association, about their new campaign, Sustain the Game, which is encouraging the government to act on its manifesto commitment of a fan-led review of the governance of football. Somehow, Kieran, producer guy has managed to make that sound a lot less interesting than it actually is. It's a five-point campaign about us getting our game back, and we had a very interesting chat with Tom. I say we. Kieran, it seemed, got called in for an early tea by the governess. That's a completely different show, that one, Kieran. Yes, we lost you on the interview, unfortunately. So it was big pictures, man, with Tom, who's details man. So I could have done with your help a couple of times. But anyway, Kieran, once again, a week without actual football has thrown up a lot of football stories, so let's crack on. I'm sure the Baroness was overjoyed to hear that FIFA have published its latest accounts.
Yes, all 226 pages of them, which kept me up most of one night. Of those 226 pages, about 210 were pictures and happy smiling faces. But I think there were a few things which perhaps are a bit of a cause for concern. FIFA lost £280 million last year, and by last year I mean 2019. Oh, wow. So therefore, that's not taking into account the pandemic. To be fair to FIFA, they have given out $1 million to each member of FIFA. There's about 209 in total to help them cope with the pandemic. I don't think it's make a huge amount of issue to the Bundesliga or the FA, but for certainly for smaller countries, it will make a difference. They have said that they're checking and they're auditing of where that money ends up has improved. A few years ago, 38% of the money that was being given out by FIFA was being withdrawn in the form of cash, which I don't really think is the way that you'd expect a football organisation to work. Our chum, Mr. Infantino, he's trousered just shy of $2 million. And I think if we're looking for a job in football, Kevin, being a council member on FIFA is where we should be looking at. They put back $35 million between them. Wow. From what they did, I'm not quite sure.
Well, that level of cash payments is all you get in the comedy industry, not the football industry. That's I'm slightly worried about the answer to this question. That £1 million, as you say, is not a lot to the big countries, but to some of those smaller countries about whom you've had doubts in the past, and their membership of FIFA, that represents a fair bit of money, I presume, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. And on top of that, they can apply to FIFA for grants as well, in order to try to top that up. Now, there are some absolutely brilliant projects which are being run by FIFA. We're hoping the money does go in respect of those. But historically has had a few problems.
OK, now talking of grants and financial aid, the Premier League is insisting that the EFL backs its opposition to an increase in homegrown player quotas after Brexit before it agrees to provide financial support for struggling clubs. That's kind of three stories in one there. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
There's been a bit of a standoff between the Premier League and the FA since the Brexit vote in 2016. The FA wants to increase the number of homegrown players from 8 to 12. And it says if it does that, it's willing to be a bit more flexible in terms of how it deals with the government in work permits from people for other countries.
Right.
So there's a bit of horse trading there. The Premier League is pushing back on that. It wants to recruit as worldwide as possible, and it would prefer to have fewer homegrown players because as far as the club owners are concerned, they're more interested in A, winning the Premier League, but B, have success in Europe, and therefore they want to recruit the best players they can worldwide in order to do that. Then apparently, and this is a story I picked up from one of the newspapers, the Premier League are in some form of negotiations with the EFL to give them a bailout of £250 million over 4 years. But in order for that to take place, the Premier League are saying to the EFL, well, we want you to come on board with our proposals for these homegrown players. And the EFL are going, well, yeah, we don't particularly care because the nature of playing in the EFL is you tend to have more homegrown players anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all a bit messy.
I would have thought, though, that given the circumstances, struggling clubs in the EFL would agree to anything for financial help, wouldn't they? I mean, if you said you have to have a giraffe in every garden, they'd have a giraffe in every garden, wouldn't they?
Well, there is this, and I can't see really why the EFL would kick up too much of a fuss unless they're trying to get better terms off the Premier League. Right. My only concern is if we go back to a topic that we've looked at a couple of times historically, which was the Elite Player Performance Plan, that was something the EFL clubs agreed to at the time because it gave them guaranteed share outs from the Premier League TV deal. But you talk to fans at most clubs, and indeed you talk to a few owners these days as well, and they now realise that under EPPP they get fairly well shafted when they've got a good player coming through as a development player, and that they end up effectively having to give them away for peanuts.
Now producer Guy has been somewhat laconic about the title of this next story, and I should explain to people, by the way, because I have been asked by one or two people, producer Guy is not a title as in Family Guy. His name is Guy, and he's the producer. So when I say producer Guy, But anyway, as I say, he's been rather laconic with the title of his name. Basically, some concerns about the price of England's new kit. And the thing is, if you Google the price of England's new kit, you get a story from every season since the internet began, basically. This is an annual story. And it's very expensive. I mean, they've gone back to the Euro 96 kit, but with very much England 2020 prices.
That's right. If you want a basic England shirt, it's going to cost you. That's called a stadium shirt.
Yeah.
That's going to cost you £70. If you want to put a name and number on it, and I find this a bit strange, given that you're not quite sure who's going to be in the England team apart from Harry Kane, then it's going to cost you £85. But if you want a match kit, it then ramps up to £100. And I was looking at some of those match kits, and they sell them in double XL. Well, you know, surely if it's a match kit, double XL shouldn't be available. Then it goes to £115 if you want a match kit with name and number. But I think the thing which sort of hacks me off even more than the prices is that the FA has joined in with this mentality that a football kit lasts for one season only.
Yeah.
England have brought out both home and away kits. They're probably going to play no more than 15 matches over the course of the next 12 months. So, you know, there's going to be some some Nations Cup matches. Hopefully they're going to go far in the European Championships next summer. But even so, we're looking at no more than 15 matches. So the home kit could end up being worn, you know, perhaps 9 or 10 times, and the away kit 4 or 5. And then they say, oh, next season, or next August, we're going to introduce another one. So you're not really getting fantastic value for money for your £70 basic and ramping up from there.
Yeah, the cost of the shirt is one thing. The price of adult shorts, replica adult shorts, is £55, which doesn't bother me because I think any adult who buys replica shorts, you can just charge him through the nose, frankly, because adults shouldn't be wearing replica shorts. But what worries me about this story is the kit's been released with a great deal of razzmatazz, as usual. And I can't help feeling the FA haven't noticed that there's a global pandemic on and people might be a little bit short of money. I mean, surely this is the time. I know kit deals notwithstanding, but surely this is the time when they say, look, you know, just for this one season, we'll keep the old kit, keep your money in your pocket. It just seems, as you say, that tin ear. They seem to have a little bit of a tin ear about this, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, it could be that they've got a contract with Nike that something has to be introduced, and it's a home and an away kit every year, and that's part of the deal. But I agree with you entirely. There is no demand. There is no demand from any football fans this week for England to introduce a new football kit. Yeah. So why they chose to bring out one, I mean, I can understand it slightly from clubs, especially if you're looking at a club such as Leeds United, which is back in the Premier League for the first time in 16 years. Yeah, I can understand that. But even so, the Leeds kit's cheaper than the England kit. Yeah. But this seems to me just to be wrong decision at the wrong time. Same as you.
Yeah, and as you say, by the time you've hilariously had Grandad 65 put on the back of your shirt, you're adding quite a few of your... ironically, somebody who probably can afford a new English shirt is Dunfermline players, because they've had some good news this week, haven't they, Dunfermline?
Yeah, I mean, Dunfermline is a fan-owned club.
Yeah.
But they've just signed an agreement with some German investors from Hamburg, one of my favourite cities.
Yeah.
the German investors are initially going to buy 30% of the club, and they could end up buying 75% with the Piles Trust, the fans organisation, will still be a minority shareholder. And I think this is a really good thing going forwards for those clubs who are fan-owned, but perhaps are now realising that in order to progress, perhaps you do need some outside investment, that they still have a significant stake in the club. So therefore, they can have their voice heard. And too often, I'm always concerned about clubs who sort of run out of money because they are fan-owned.
Yeah.
And therefore, somebody comes in and says, well, I'm going to take it all or nothing. But this looks really good. Certainly, the German owners are saying the right thing. I'm a huge fan of Dunfermline, mainly because of my love of the Skids. So good luck to all at East End Park.
Yeah, and the Skids are a band, by the way, just for those, I don't know why I say America, but there will be confused listeners all over the world wondering why Kieran loves the Skids so much. Surely not in his brand new sports car. And Dunfermline historically are a club in Scotland. You know, they were Jock Stein's first club. They've won the cup. I think I've mentioned this before, my favourite ever photographs was from, I think it was a shoot annual from 1969, where a Dunfermline player was in such agony, he was biting the shin pad of a Partick Thistle player. So they're a big club, but I'm always fascinated, and I know I do always ask you this, which way round it comes? Would these people in Hamburg have been casting around for a club in British football or Scottish football specifically, or will Dunfermline have said, look, as you say, we've gone as far as we can go with fan ownership and fan investment. Let's find somebody to invest in the club.
Well, I've listened to the comments from the German investors, and they've been looking all over Europe. I think it's intriguing that they've decided to go for Scotland because, Dunfermline are presently in the Championship, but a wee bit of investment could take them to the Scottish Premiership. And remember, Scotland are now going to have two clubs going into the preliminary rounds of the Champions League. Yeah. With a bit of an investment, you could get into Europe in either the Champions League or the Europa League. And that is a game changer for club finances. Dunfermline lost 700 grand last season, so they were in need of financial support, and it seems to have come at just the right time.
Now, I think you probably 17 minutes that you've had between reading the FIFA report and researching for this show, you've had a look at which Premier League teams made the biggest profit on player sales over the last 2 years. Why can't you just relax, Kim? Take the dog out for a walk every now and again. No wonder the dog was so delighted when the next door neighbour showed up.
Well, this came about because there's been lots of grumbles and fingers pointed at Chelsea, because Chelsea have spent heavily over the course of this summer as far as the transfer market is concerned. So, and people are saying, well, how can they possibly do that in the context of financial fair play? So, to satisfy my own curiosity and to upset the Baroness even further, I went through the whole of the last decade, every set of accounts of the last decade, and Chelsea made almost £500 million from selling players. And that's before they sold Eden Hazard last summer. So the reason why Chelsea can be successful in the transfer market in terms of buying is because they are the most successful club in the Premier League. In each of the last four seasons, and I suspect it's going to be five, they've brought in more money and more profit from player sales than any other club. So they've made 120 more than Spurs. They made £300 million more than Manchester City, £350 million more than Manchester United, and also Palace. So if you've got money coming in from player sales, it allows you to spend it on effectively whoever you want.
Fair enough. We're still on FFP. You've seen Lionel Messi play. I would love to see Lionel Messi play at Selhurst Park, if only for the look on his face as an actual eagle screams towards him just before kickoff. But many people are wondering how, and it looks like Man City are the only lively Premier League club, and there are rumours of a deal in the region of £623 million. But many people are saying, how can that possibly happen without City breaking FFP rules?
Well, I think there's a variety of issues here. I mean, we don't know what the transfer fee is going to be. This figure of £623 million is the estimate for, I think, around about £100 million of fee to Barcelona. And the rest is going into Lionel Messi's remuneration package. Now, Manchester City, and I counted them, have 43 sponsors and partners.
Wow.
Now, what they could do is that they could go to one of their sponsors. You know, they've got IT companies, they've got gambling partners and so on. And they can say, well, look, guys, we looked at the roster and I'm not taking out on these players. But this year you've got John Stones and Kyle Walker to advertise your to organize your noodle company.
Yeah.
And that's going to, you know, and the deal we signed was £1.5 million. If you want to double that, we could have a word with Lionel Messi.
Yeah.
How do you fancy doing that? And you only need, you know, half of City's partners to do that. Then all of a sudden, yeah, that's going to bring in an extra £30 or £40 million. I tried to find something similar. So is there a global superstar who moved clubs at the age of 33? And what was the impact on the accounts? And I was going to look at Glenn Murray signing for Brighton, but I decided to go for Cristiano Ronaldo moving from Real Madrid to Juventus.
Similar players.
Often mistaken for one another.
Similar temperament, yeah.
And Juventus's income went up by 52 million as a result of Cristiano Ronaldo signing. Now, I think City, with they're in a more advantageous position in terms of their partners and so on. I think City could probably top that. And also, we then sort of move into the world of the City Football Group. We've mentioned them before.
Yes, yes.
They own seven or eight clubs. So I know your favourite topic in the world is the amortisation of football players, where we take the cost of the fee and you spread it over the life of the contract. Realistically, I don't think Lionel Messi would play in the Premier League for more than 3 years. But what they could do is get him to sign a five-year deal, and at the end of three of those 5 years, he then hops across to New York, where the pace of football is perhaps a little bit hectic, and therefore Manchester City won't have paid 2 years of amortization. So, you know, there are ways around this particular deal, which could make it actually break even from City's perspective.
Well, I'm going to make this question sound different to how it would have been, because I don't want to, again, repeat myself about us being married for too long. Do you, outside a City Group type situation where you've got 12 or 13 clubs under the same umbrella, have you heard of any deals where a club signs a player for 3 years and then says the last 2 years of this five-year contract will be at another club?
No, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Right.
I mean, you know, what I'm putting forward is a suggestion. You know, and it might just be an amazing coincidence that Lionel Messi moves to another part of the City Football Group, but it certainly is one of the benefits of having sort of a mothership and satellite clubs. So it is feasible. You know, the alternative would be for City to play him for 3 years and then try to find an independent club. But, you know, given that his wages are likely to be eye-wateringly big, who is going to pay that type of money? And in theory, also have to go and pay Manchester City a fee for someone who's 36 or 37.
Also, I can't help but thinking that this is actually financially good news for the rest of the Premier League. It might make Man City stronger favourites to win it, depending on how you feel about whether he's the player he was. But any game against Man City is going to be sold out in advance now. I mean, and someone like Fulham, who still have that neutral bit, they can charge what they want when Man City comes, because there are going to be people who pay £300 on the off chance that Lionel Messi will be playing in the Premier League and they have their only chance to see him.
Yep. And you think about, there's quite a few clubs that have sort of A, B and C matches and tiered prices. Now, no disrespect to City, but they're not always classified as an A opposition, because that tends to be for the clubs with a bit more of a glamorous background, the likes of Manchester United, Chelsea and Liverpool. But I think it would certainly stick City into that particular group when they're trying to sell tickets to home fans. So therefore, I agree with you entirely. The whole of the Premier League is going to benefit from the sort of the reflected glory of Lionel Messi.
And even with all of City's money and potential money, do you think if they do get Messi for this huge, huge figure, that would be the end of their transfer spending for this season and possibly next as well?
No, because remember, they've sold Leroy Sané for around about 50 million. I think what they might have to do is a bit more encouragement of a few players out of the door. But there's no reason, if he brings in an extra 50 or 60 million a year of revenue, then to a certain extent, he's going to be paying for himself.
Now, this company, we mentioned right at the very start of this pod when we had, 37 listeners in the first couple of weeks. And thank you if all of them are still listening in amongst the tens of thousands that have joined us since. 23 Capital, a lender that specialised in delivering creative loans, guys put here, for football and entertainment industries. They appear to be winding down. I'm guessing this is an important story, but why?
Well, I think actually it's reflecting the state of the transfer market. This company, 23 Capital, it arranged finance for your industry, the entertainment industry, and the football, and it sort of effectively had two arms. But it only tended to deal in the big transfers, the likes of Griezmann going to Barcelona for 120 million euros, João Felix going to Madrid for 126, and those deals simply aren't around anymore. And it looks as if 23 Capital themselves, what they used to do was that they would borrow money, say at 2%, and then they'd lend it to the football clubs at 6% to fund this deal. And they've said, and this is silver tongues talk here, but they've said that we've had to realign a finance facility with one of our lenders, which suggests to me that the banks that are lending to them are getting a little bit twitchy. But the sad thing, and I don't care what industry you're working in, the sad industry, 23 Capital are making staff redundant by the looks of things, which I think it just shows that the glory days of the transfer market are no longer there.
Yeah, and I also should point out that when you refer to the loans to my industry, there's very much a Premier League and a Champions League and a Championship and then League One and League Two in my industry, and those loans are not trickling down to my end of the industry. Let's put it that way. Now, we finished before our interview with Tom Greatorex. Two stories about social responsibility. The first one, Kieran, listeners may have seen it sort of tucked away on the BBC website or a couple of others, but an American listener of ours, Mike Bernardi, added some details. It does take a little bit of explaining before I get to the question. You'll know that many US athletes refused to take part in competition sport last week as a protest against the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin. Some of those athletes were the players of Real Salt Lake and LAFC, who refused to fulfill the fixture against each other. A move that Salt Lake's owner, Del Loy Hansen, it's a serious story, but it's very hard to resist saying smooth operator after you say Del Loy Hansen. Anyway, the owner, Del Loy Hansen, described this as profoundly disrespectful to him personally and said it's like being stabbed. He then threatened job losses and redundancies across the board because of it, and he's now put the club up for sale. That's the shortest way I could find of asking, where do players stand financially, Kieran, when they make a stand like that? I mean, it's the right thing to do, I think, but in terms of their contracts and in terms of how the owner responded, and I presume sponsors are waging, how does it work for players like that?
Well, I mean, US law is slightly different to UK employment law. It would depend whether or not it was deemed to be gross misconduct. The MLS Players Union has come out in support, and also, you know, this is one of the issues which I think Tom was referring to in his interview. The MLS has said it's trying to force Delroy Hansen to sell the club.
Yeah.
So this is an example of the football authorities standing up to owners as opposed to being part of the ownership clique. So I think players, they've just stood on principle. Ultimately, you know, this club, Rail Salt Lake, it can't play football without players. So if there is unity between all players of all clubs, and they simply say, well, if you're going to sack the existing squad, we're not going to take their place. And then how are you going to play football?
Mm. Okay, and another player here with a proper social conscience is Marcus Rashford. I really hope we can find some way of making him BBC Sports Personality of the Year, because, I mean, he's at it again. He's got the bit between his teeth, and fair play to him.
That's right. He's got involved with some of the food retailers, the likes of Tesco, Aldi, Sainsbury and Deliveroo. And it's to do with supporting people who are in financial difficulty, who have children.
Yeah.
And the objectives of his campaign is, first of all, to expand free school meals. And what people don't realise, the Baroness is out of the house at present, because she would be steaming in at present, because she used to be a school head.
Mm.
And she used to go and visit the kids who didn't turn up to school, where she knew the parents, for whatever reason. It could be booze, it could be drugs, it could be just bone idle.
Yeah.
Couldn't be asked sending their kids into school. And the only guaranteed meal that a lot of these kids were getting was at school. So Marcus Rashford, and hats off to the guy, he wants to expand free school meals. He also wants to expand holiday food and holiday activities,
yeah,
again, to those kids whose parents might be on universal credit, who are going to need financial assistance. He wants to increase the Healthy Start voucher scheme. And all of these things, these are investments in children going forwards. Now, he's seen the benefit of that investment. You know, the UK Exchequer benefits from Marcus Rashford, who had a, you know, it didn't have it easy when he was growing up, and his mum did her very best to feed the family, but it wasn't easy. And now look at him. He's a successful, talented individual who earns a lot of money, and a large proportion of that money comes back to the country. So if you invest in your kids, it pays off. You know, and educating people out of poverty and using the activities of somebody with such a high profile of Marcus Rashford, I just got, you know, my hat is permanently raised in his direction.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And part of it, it's not just the financial aspect to this, but it's the fact that by him admitting that he had free school dinners as a kid, that his mum used food banks and other social assets, it's taking away the terrible stigma that still exists for hundreds of thousands of kids that are very, you know, from very poor backgrounds, and it's actually showing them that you know, there's no shame in having to rely on food banks or free school dinners. It's a good thing to be taken advantage of, and it's the bad thing to take it away from kids. And also because it gives us, and we probably bang on about this every fourth pod, Kieran, and it's important that we keep banging on about it, because it just shows that, you know, Marcus Rashford, he doesn't want the publicity, but he's working at a very high level. He's getting companies together that wouldn't dream of cooperating with each other. But every single club, at every level of football, down to Clapton in the ninth level that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, they will all have players that are doing stuff on a local basis. Roy Hodgson always talks about the players at Palace. You'll have players at Brighton on a very local basis. And I'm sure there's some kind of quinoa bank in the middle of Brighton, I don't know. But there are, even in Sussex, there are areas of poverty in Sussex that Brighton players will be doing their best to help. And it's important that we shine a light on this and don't we must get away from this thing that footballers are ignorant, greedy, selfish young men, because the vast majority of them simply aren't.
I've talked quite a few footballers, and they're an absolute delight. And remember that they tend to come, because if you look at the demographic profile, the majority of footballers come from working class families. So, you know, they are aware of their community when they from where they've come from, where they've grown up. And a lot of them are full of responsibility.
Yeah, I had a really interesting chat with a Premier League club CEO last year, who was saying that one of the issues with signing African players is that in their contracts they want things included, that, you know, that a certain amount of the money has to go at source to various charities all over the world, and that's a great problem to have. But again, these are things we're not hearing about. We're just seeing the, you know, the transfer fees, agents fees, wages, blah blah blah. Anyway, it's a terrible admission of a lack of vocabulary, isn't it? Blah blah blah. It's interview time, Kieran, and because I think you did drop out here at some stage. I think you're probably too posh where you live. It probably doesn't like signals coming down from South London sometimes. Is that, you think that's what it might be? You think it's like one of those adverts you see for cameras on the door, so you can look out the window and see where the radio waves are coming? Radio waves. So I'll go Agatha Christie, the radio waves. So we'll listen to the interview, which is very interesting, and then I'll ask you to pick up on a couple of things that Tom told us. Tom is Tom Greatrex, who's vice chair of a great organisation, the Football Supporters Association. I spoke to him just a few moments ago about their new campaign, Sustain the Game.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Tom, thank you for joining us. Before you tell us about Sustain the Game, tell us a little bit about the Football Supporters Association and your involvement with it.
Yes, the Football Supporters Association was formed year and a bit ago, merger of Supporters Direct, which was the umbrella body for supporters trusts, and what was called the Football Supporters Federation. Supporters Direct, I was chair of previously, and we focus mostly on governance issues, the FSF, on a wide range of other issues, and we joined together to make one representative fans group for English football, and I'm currently the vice chair of the FSA.
And before we go through the five main principles of this frankly brilliant campaign, tell us why now.
Now, because really arising from, well, actually it's probably the last 12 months with what happened with Bury, and the way in which we started to detect, you know, amongst football authorities that have basically been pretty complacent about it up until then, a sense that some of the issues that we've been banging around for years were actually pretty integral to the health of the game going forward and for the future. And that has really been exacerbated by the not yet realised, but we can all see and feel coming, consequence of the shutdown and COVID and everything that relates to in relation to lack of match day revenue, and the fact that, frankly, most professional football clubs in the English system, and including down into the sort of some of the semi-professional leagues, operate on a pretty unsustainable basis, and they gamble every year, or a lot of them gamble every year. And they're pretty perilous position. I think that has been brought home to a lot of people in very recent times. And we thought it was a good opportunity to really pull together the issues we think need to be addressed to reform football in England, so we can protect clubs going through difficult situations, but importantly, so that when things are back on an even keel, which we hope is soon enough, that clubs are sustainable and the health of the game can continue, because that's what, as fans, we want to see. We want to see competitive leagues. We want to see, you know, our teams doing well on the pitch. But we don't want to see that happening at the expense of the clubs that we all invest so much time and effort and love and ambition and hope and emotion into.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention matchday revenue, because about an hour ago, out of the blue, Palace revealed their season ticket applications were now open. And there's about 40 of us on a WhatsApp group. And frankly, we need Bletchley Park to sort out who's how we're going to get in, how many games we get to see, what games we get to see. So that at least it's encouraging that there is a season ticket on offer for some reason. There are five principles, Tom, all as important as each other. The first principle of the Sustain the Game plan is protect our clubs.
Yeah, we think it's really important that football clubs, which are community assets, and, you know, I listen to the pod regularly, and I heard you just recently talking about some of the issues around when clubs and grounds get separated into separate ownership and some of the consequences that we've seen of that in a whole number of different cases. And obviously there are some cases now where that is or is about to be the case. I think it's one of the most worrying things actually from the Wigan situation, that you could have a situation where potentially the ground would be in different ownership from the club. And, you know, I'm a Fulham supporter. We've been in that situation going way back in the sort of 1980s with property developer owning the ground. So, you know, protecting those assets that are really, I think, you know, important signifiers of local and individual identity. When you think about the Bury situation, people like me that grew up in the south of England, I only ever heard of Bury because of the football team. You know, the name of the town and the football team, and whether it's going back to your, you know, league ladders from Shute and everything else in the past, that's where you'd heard of these places. And it really, I think, struck a lot of people when this time last year, when you had the still owner of what was Bury Football Club sort of saying in a blasé way, I didn't even know there was a football club in Bury when I bought it. Mm-hmm. You know, juxtaposing that with the people whose, you know, their entertainment, their, you know, their identity with their town, what they do on Saturdays and have done through generations of their family, just being ripped away from them. You know, clubs are not just any other business. They're not even any other leisure business. You know, they are community assets, and they need to be recognised as such. And there need to be protections in place, I think, for those assets to survive, regardless of the various different ownership structures that football clubs will have from time to time. Because
go on, mate.
I was going to say, because, you know, owners will come and go, and some will be very good and some will be less good, and some will preside over good periods and some over bad periods. But the constant is the club, the association with the supporters, and the identity with of the place in which those clubs exist.
See, I'm a comedian, Tom, and I'm a man of words. So I get furious when Kieran occasionally says something funny, which I should have said. It really annoys me. And occasionally I come across a phrase that I think, that's the phrase I've been looking for years. And on your website, I've been trying to find the right words for years to talk about the level of protection that football clubs need. And on your website, it's quite simple. Football clubs need a level of protection in keeping with listed buildings or conservation areas. And that's it. They do need that. There needs to be something that you can slap on the ground and say, this is not yours, this is ours. You leave it alone.
Yeah. And I think, I think you know, what has happened with a number of clubs in over a course of a few years, I think just underlines that. You know, more and more. And I think what's happening now is that is starting to be recognised as being, this isn't just about a minority voice of a few people that have been going on about this for years. This is actually something that's pretty integral to protecting the game. And, you know, when you think about it at the Premier League level, when you're having, you know, all the statements that the executives of the Premier League make about what a successful product it is, one of the reasons why it's successful is because it is, the Premier League is part of, albeit in some ways imperfect, but it's part of a system of a set of leagues in England with promotion, relegation, competition, opportunity. And, you know, my team and Wigan and Hull and Swansea are all teams I could think of in the recent past who've been in all four divisions. And that moving up and down, the integrity of that pyramid is integral to what makes, I would say, the Premier League as attractive as a marketeer's product, if you want to think of it in those terms, as much as it is the players that get attracted to the big teams. It's all about the integrity of the pyramid, and that has to be protected. And it's no good for the Premier League to sort of, on one hand, say that and say they recognise that and they recognise the role of fans and warm words, but to be then in a situation where if they're not against, they have been in the past, not so much now, but frustrating, I think, some of the case for reform and protection. Because it's about, in the end, it's about protecting the game, which is in the interest of the people who own the clubs. It's in the interest of the governing body, the institutions. It's in the interest of supporters and in the interest of communities they serve.
Yeah. Well, funnily enough, strengthen the pyramid is one of the other principles. I think we've dealt with that. I want Kieran to deal with the next two, Kieran, if you don't mind, because they're two things that are very close to your heart. And transparency about ownership and financial control. So just talk us about those two, through those two things, Tom.
Yeah, again, I think these are really important and drawn from experience. The Sports Direct and the FSA worked on some proposals, which actually we took to the FA board, which was an interesting experience, and over the course of the last year, and got their sort of outline support and backing, which is, you know, we have in England that from time to time had a situation where we don't know who owns the clubs.
Yeah,
you know, and the most obvious, very, very recent example, which we sort of did know but didn't really know, is what's happened at Wigan. And you can see the consequence of that. But it's not that long ago that the then chief executive of Leeds United, who went on to other things afterwards, was in front of, I think, a parliamentary select committee and couldn't say who owned Leeds United. You know, there is I think, a really important principle here about people having the right to know who owns their club, and then how the clubs operate within the framework that they're supposed to. Because if you don't, that's when, and there isn't enough level of scrutiny on it, that's when bad things happen and they can't be rescued then. You know, in a situation where things aren't, you know, you aren't able to monitor what's happening, and therefore you aren't able to potentially step in or challenge or make public various things that could help to, you know, stop a bad situation getting worse. It's nearly always the case that when supporters end up in a position of having to, you know, really protest or be in a position where they're trying to save a club, be that, you know, what's happening at Charlton at the moment or what's happening at Wigan, whatever the situation is, that often happens right at the very end when it's almost too late for anything else. And that shouldn't be the case.
Supporter management is the last of the principles, basically.
Supporter engagement in the...
Supporter engagement, sorry. Yeah, I can't read my own writing here, sorry. Yeah.
Of supporters. You know, we've got different models of ownership in English football. There are some clubs that are community-owned and supporter-owned, be that the likes of Exeter or AFC Wimbledon. There are other clubs that have been at various points and that now aren't, again, like Portsmouth. And it's very interesting, the interview you have with Clapton the other week as well, and the way in which that club has been brought together and is very successful. Look, what sits behind this is that fans are the lifeblood of the game. They're the lifeblood of clubs up and down the country. They're the only people, I think, you know, who are, as a group, a constant in a club. You know, everybody else comes and goes from time to time. And they have always the best interests of the club at heart because they want the club to survive and to prosper. I think it's just absolutely right that they have a voice in the clubs and the issues that affect them. And you could do that in different ways. You know, in some cases, there have been and there are supporter representatives on boards. The supporters have a stake sometimes in clubs. In others, like Portsmouth, for example, they have a heritage board, which means the things that are perhaps most important to fans about, you know, things that might seem trivial but aren't, are about the identity, things like badge, kit colours. You know, you've seen what's names of clubs, things that have happened, how in other places are protected. And there's some really great examples of supporter engagement. I mean, give Accrington Stanley as an example, as an English league club, where I think the owner at Accrington, you know, work on a very small budget with a team which doesn't attract huge crowds, which has been out of the league and come back into it. He really understands and gets what Accrington's about.
Yeah.
And he involves the supporters. And, you know, if you involve people, you probably get better decisions and they understand some of the parameters of some of those decisions and why you can't do some of the things that you might, you know, think superficially would be the best things to do. And that is just very, very healthy. And where it has happened and it happens well, those are the healthiest, best run, most connected clubs in the whole of the country. And where it doesn't happen, that's where you get the problems.
That heritage thing is really interesting because you also suggested a code of practice on the stewardship of football clubs to the FA, covering things like kit changes and name changes, but also tax responsibility and not loading a club with debt to finance its purchase. Did the FA welcome that, that, report that, those suggestions? Have they responded at all?
Yeah, so the FA, we presented to the FA board back in November time. We took a motion. I'm a member, I'm a supporter representative on the FA council, so I suppose in a sort of bizarre sense, I'm one of the Blazers that people talk about. And, you know, it's very interesting in those discussions that the FA, members of that FA council and the FA board, I think a year or so, a bit more than a year ago, 18 months ago, you would have had them sort of nod their head and say, well, all very interesting, but it's not really our game. You know, this isn't not our game. This isn't our bag, really. This is for other people to do. That attitude has started to shift. Now, not to the extent that we would like. We would like the FA to do what every other UEFA nation governing body does, which is basically regulate and license the game in those countries. We in England have abdicated that responsibility and given it to the leagues. And the problem, as you know, is that the leagues are the clubs. And so there is self-interest baked into that. And that means there are short-term decisions made quite often that aren't for the good of the game as a whole, but what suit a majority of the clubs at a particular time. And those two things aren't always consistent with each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the FA are aware there are some real issues, and they're particularly interested and aware because the bad practice then reflects on the good practice, if you see what I mean. So the clubs like Accrington or Tranmere, or, you know, clubs that are well run, that have that level of involvement amongst supporters in their communities, you know, those sort of model clubs get tarred with the same brush of whoever it is who, you know, the two different owners who basically did for Bury in the Football League, or, you know, what the, I think he is still the current, isn't he? The current owner of Charlton.
He is.
The owner of Charlton, yeah. Done, you know, all those things. You know, it reflects badly on the clubs that are well run. And this is where I think we're starting to make a bit of progress on this, because those clubs, I think, are getting fed up with being, you know, being tarred with the same brush. And also with, and you know, Mark Pallias at Tranmere is really interesting on this, realizing that actually the system of regulation that we have at the moment isn't fit for purpose. There aren't the right type of financial and sustainability controls, and the fit and proper persons test and the owners and directors test, you know, just doesn't work because it's a snapshot in time and it's a pretty much a tick box exercise. What there should be, and it's analogous to other industries, is ongoing monitoring that enables problems to be picked up, and not, you know, not to punish people, but to say, well, look, these are ways in which other clubs have been able to deal with some of these things. And, you know, then it's a self-reinforcing thing. It's actually then it helps to sustain the health of the game as a whole, which is basically what this is about. You know, everything that we talk about in terms of sustain the game, as it sort of says on the tin, it's about the health and sustainability of English football as a whole, so that we, supporters of whatever clubs, and people like you that do this great podcast, you know, I'd love to be in a position where you have much, much less to talk about.
Actually. Yeah, quite right. So would we. Okay.
Yeah. So you can concentrate on supporting your teams and noting what's happening in the game, but not doing it with a backdrop of, you know, almost juggling a whole number of clubs that are in really difficult situations at any one time. We want to get beyond that. And that's what this is about. And, you know, I'm optimistic, more optimistic than I have been for a long time. The level of support from not just supporters, but from within the game, from the political stakeholders across all political parties, and from those like yourselves, you know, informed commentators and pundits and people who take an interest in football, because of the current situation and what's happened in the recent past, I think, you know, now is there's more of an opportunity now to address some of these things once and for all as they need to be. And if we don't, all that will happen is we'll be back having the same conversation, but with, you know, clubs 1, 2, and 3 instead of Charlton, Wigan, and whoever else is in the frame at the moment.
I do you know what? I'm slightly taken aback, as I haven't heard the word optimism on this pod for quite some considerable months, and it's again for the second pod running, I'm welling up a bit. Now, you talk about the FA's response and you talk about government agency response, but part of the Sustain the Game campaign is to hold the government to account for its manifesto promise of a fan-led review of the governance of football. Do you think they are committed to it, and how do you answer those people who inevitably say, well, at the moment, the government may just have other priorities to worry about?
Yeah, and you know, look, to be it's a fair point that you know, the COVID pandemic and everything associated with it came along a few months ago, and it basically has stopped the government doing lots of other things that it was probably planning on doing. But we know from our discussions, not just with politicians, but also with civil servants, that this is a manifesto commitment. It's a commitment which has the support of the opposition party in Parliament as well. So it's something they can do with wider support. Mm. And that it's something we hope that over the course of the autumn we'll get started. Now, the devil will be in the detail, as all these things are, you know, in terms of the terms of reference and the structure and everything else. But actually, to have, you know, I've not been making a party political statement, but to have a Conservative Party manifesto which talks about the need for a fan-led review into the sustainability and the way in which football is run, to have the likes of Damien Collins, who you had on the other day, talking about some of these issues in the way that he did, and he's a very eloquent and articulate commentator on these issues, and has obviously, you know, the time when he was chair of the Select Committee, has gone into them in quite some detail and depth of understanding. That you've got that broad range of political voices saying this is needed, I think that's why I'm cautiously optimistic in a way that I might not have been before, because you know, they have been the bits that have been hard to reach, and I think those elements of this discussion have got to the point where they understand there does need to be reform. That won't happen by just saying to the leagues, you need to do some reform. You know, that needs more of a push than that, because we've been there in the past and you have the warm words and then it all goes away when something else comes along. We've got to avoid that happening, and we've got to really make this count this time. And I think that's what we've got a good chance of being able to do.
Just finally, it won't surprise you to learn, Tom, that obviously here at POF Towers, we're 100% behind the campaign, and the most cursory glance at every football website in the country basically indicates that every football fan is behind it. So what can our listeners do to help with this campaign?
So what we would like people to do is to sign up to the campaign. You can do that on the FSA website. If you're able to, if you're involved in, be it podcasts or fan supporter organisations, get them to sign up to it. Write to your MPs, ask them to sign up to it. A number have, but there are still others we want to get. And, you know, if you're in a position where you're able to have some interaction with the people that are involved in running your club, make clear to them that this is something that is really important. You know, it's important to know whether you're going to be able to get, how many games you're going to be able to get to, you know, at Selhurst Park with a reduced capacity and for how long. You know, those are obviously really important things. It's important to know who you're going to have playing up front next season and how that's going to affect your and Fulham's chances of trying to finish in the top 17. But it is more important that the game is sustained, that we know that the Football League and the Premier League and the National League and the leagues that feed into it are on a sustainable footing. They can survive in the future the disruption of something like a pandemic. We hope we don't have another one, but you know, those, the ability to be able to survive through that. And that the values and the identity that comes from your football clubs and your communities up and down the country is protected. That is the most important thing, I think, in football. You know, the other stuff is obviously immediately important and where most of the attention is. But without the bedrock of sustainability, then the rest of football is potentially at risk, and some of the clubs are at risk. And we don't want to see that happen. We want to protect and sustain the game. Supporters have an important part to play and an important voice in all of this. And we think with the package of reforms that we're talking about in terms of identity, supporter involvement, financing, transparency, we put the game on a much, much sounder footing for the future.
Tom, thank you so much for talking to us and articulating a lot of the things that we've trampled around for the last year or so on this pod. Obviously, if there's anything else we can do to help you, we will. And we wish you all the very best, and we'll talk to you again soon, Tom. Thanks a lot, mate.
Thank you very much.
Kieran, I know you were listening to that campaign. I had the rather surreal experience of you trying to put things in the chat and me trying to answer them, which wasn't always successful for two men of our age. But there are five main principles of the Sustain the Game campaign. And two of them in particular I wanted to include you in. The five main principles, as we heard: protect our club, strengthen the pyramid, supporter engagement, and then transparency about ownership and financial controls. The transparency about ownership, Kieran, is something you talk about a lot. It's a big bee in your bonnet. But just in terms of accounting and law, is it something that is achievable, transparency over ownership? I mean, it doesn't necessarily exist in other businesses. So why is it so important that it exists in football?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. It doesn't necessarily exist in other businesses. And remember, we do have Premier League clubs, which are controlled by companies in the Bahamas, in the British Virgin Islands, in the Cayman Islands, and so on. And it makes it difficult. Now, you know, we don't go to football for transparency, but you like to have a little bit of comfort. Under present rules, there is nothing to force clubs. But this comes back to one of the issues that Tom was sort of also raising. Self-regulation versus being regulated is potentially the way forwards. The existing football authorities, and we spoke earlier in the pod about, we've got the FA and the EFL and the Premier League, two of whom represent club owners, and the third lot represent a bunch of Blazers, none of whom really represent fans. I think we either need to recognise that football, and as Tom and you were rightly saying, football is unique. It is an integral part of British society, and football grounds are listed. Well, football clubs should be listed companies in the sense that they have to give more information in terms of ownership, more transparency. We've still got clubs, and this, as you know, winds me up. We've still got clubs that haven't bothered to publish their 2019 accounts because they know if they just pay a £150 fine, they get away with fans knowing absolutely nothing. So it can go forwards, but it needs more than the present authorities.
One of the few club CEOs who's publicly responded to the Sustain the Game campaign, which only started last week and it's already got a lot of publicity, was Mark Catlin at Portsmouth, who seems to be one of the good guys. And he welcomed the Sustain the Game campaign, but said, and I quote, "It's not a silver bullet." And rather disappointingly said that self-sustainability is all but impossible. Would you agree with that?
I agree with him that it's not a silver bullet. You could have a person with good intentions take over a club, and for whatever reason, they end up skint. You know, you've had that with Mark Goldberg.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't automatically get rid of our no wrong-uns scenario. In terms of the game being sustainable, well, you know, we have spoken about having some form of insurance policy, similar to that what we've seen with airlines, similar to what we've seen with travel agents. And if you want to buy a club, instead of this ridiculous situation where football clubs are changing hands for £1.
That
encourages shysters. That encourages wrong-uns who think that they can flip a club. If you say, if you buy a football club, and these are the regulations of the EFL or the FA, if you want to play in our competition, as well as that £1 for buying the club, you've got to put down, you know, 1 million, 2 million, 5 million, depending on what the division is, then it will automatically filter out those people who are in it for the pure self-interest.
Yeah, I think, to be fair to Mark Goldberg, any Palace fans listening would probably want to downgrade him from wrong-un to naive-un. To be honest, because he basically behaved the way I would behave if I came into a bit of money. I'd buy the club, and then he just got ran rings around by people who knew a lot more about finance than he did. But I mean, again, it's a classic example. He bought the club for all the right reasons at the right time and was just out of his depth and left us in the worst situation and was very, very upset about it. But he's a really nice bloke who held his hands up and admitted that it was his fault, but for the right reason. So, and there are people like that in football. But again, it's the good guys that need to be protected by regulation as much as the Steve Dales of this world. Anyway, Kieran, this is the time that's become traditional in the last 4 weeks where I hand it over to you because I can't trust myself to say the big purple thing without giggling. So last few words, Kieran, from you.
Okay, well, thanks again for the feedback, folks. We do sort of listen, but if you could go to your Apple Podcast app, and if you've enjoyed the show, if you can give us 5 stars, for some reason, and producer guy knows the reason why, he's never bothered to tell myself and Kevin, probably because we just nod like a pair of nodding dogs and not have a clue what they're saying. But if you could give us a 5-star review, it really helps us as far as the ratings are concerned. It allows us to book guests and things of that nature. It will make a difference. It doesn't matter what you say. Apparently, you can say, you know, will it allow us to get somebody professional and replace me with a Swiss ramble? You know, it's not for our ego. We don't care about what you write. We're big enough to be able to cope with it. But so thanks for all your feedback. And of course, stay safe. And if you've got any questions for the show, and we've got a big bank of questions, we're going to try and work our way through them. Of course, it's questions@priceoffootball.com.
Whoa, hang on. Whoa, that's my bit. You talk about expanding your part.
Well, yeah, I've been inspired by your theatrical background, Kevin.
Yeah, and I also feel on a bound to say what I always say. You might not be upset by bad reviews. I just go under the duvet for 2 days. So do bear that in mind. And I'm going to, yes, questions@priceoffootball.com. Thank you. And you can have your 2 last words now, Kieran. Thank you.
Stay safe.
The Price of Football. The Price of Football.